Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's a section in the Boston Globe Ideas section called Uncommon Knowledge, Surprising Insights from the Social Sciences. It's the kind of place where you'll read things like The Upside of Trauma or The Downside of Diversity, studies on why people who wear seatbelts are happier and why Facebook users are less positive. Frankly, these are the sort of counterintuitive scientific findings that make radio producers and newspaper writers salivate, all of us here at Word of Mouth included. Recently, the reliability and methodology behind many such studies has come into question in a big way. In a recent article for Pacific Standard magazine, author and journalist Jerry Adler details a growing crisis within the field of social psychology and efforts being made to address it. Jerry, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Yeah, you write about a practical joke that highlights the problem here. Tell us about what Joseph Simmons and his colleagues set out to prove and why their experiment is such a big deal.
Well, what they set out to prove was something impossible, something not just counterintuitive, not just unlikely, but absolutely, literally impossible. And what they settled on was that people who listened to a particular music, a particular song, and they chose the Beatles' When I'm 64, are actually younger than people who listen to something else.
And how did they prove this?
Well, the trick was to use all of the accepted standard methods of social science and psychology. I mean, it would be easy enough to just make up the data. And one of the things that I talk about in my article is that there's a fair amount of that going on. But they didn't want to do that. They used real data. They recruited a bunch of undergraduates. They played one of three different songs for them. And then the real trick is they used statistical manipulation of their results in order to achieve a level of what's called statistical significance. That is, they found what they were looking for and applied mathematical manipulation in order to get that result and came up with something that could have been published. Was published, but as a with an acknowledgement that it was a hoax.
Okay, so you said accepted forms of statistics. What are some of the acceptable ways that social scientists might, let's say, torture data into supporting a hypothesis?
It's very interesting. The standard for acceptance of a paper in a peer-reviewed psychological journal typically is set at what they call P less than 0.05, P being the probability that the results that you got were the result of chance, and 0.05 being essentially 5%. In other words, there is less than a 1 in 20 chance that the results you got were simply nature throwing you a curve.
Hmm.
And there's a whole set of techniques called p-hacking for getting your results into that magic zone. One of the simplest things you do is you start out with, say, 10 or 20 subjects in your experiment, and you look at the results that you get from them. And if they aren't what you want, well, then you add five more and you look again. And you keep doing this until you get the results you want, and then you stop.
Did you say that these are peer-reviewed studies? I mean, something can be peer-reviewed and still pass muster if it's manipulating data in this manner?
That's right. In the paper that Joseph Simmons and his colleagues published, they explained everything that they did. And of course, if you did that on your paper, it would not be published. People would say, "This is, you know, you're faking it." But if they had left that out, and it is entirely acceptable to leave it out, then the paper could have been published in a peer-reviewed publication. There are lots and lots of ways that people can do this. One of the other things that you do is you correct for various factors among your subjects,
mm-hmm.
perfectly acceptable and perfectly justified in some cases. Maybe women show the effect and men don't, or vice versa. So
right.
you throw out the ones that don't. But you just do whatever you need to do to get your results over that threshold.
So I'm going to go back to this idea that if something doesn't look quite right in hindsight, you should be able to go back and re-examine raw data. But they can keep stuff out that looks bad. First question, does anybody go back and look at the raw data?
Well, until now, it's been unusual to do that. There is a movement within social science, and I want to emphasize that these things are being undertaken by psychologists and social scientists themselves who want to clean up their act, to require that raw data be made available online, if not necessarily within the paper itself, so that other people can look at it. There is a kind of self-correcting movement here.
Jerry Adler is with us. We're talking about structural problems in social psychology and other fields that have led to the publication of some very dubious findings in recent years. You write about some of those projects created to push back against this trend. One of them is called the Reproducibility Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it got started?
Right. One of the questions that people have been asking and never really had an answer to was how much of what gets published in these journals and therefore enters the scientific canon can actually be reproduced. If you go and do the same experiment again, how likely are you to get the same results? And this actually began with a young psychologist named Joseph Nozick at University of Virginia, who did a fabulous experiment with one of his grad students. He looked at the question of whether political moderates, who are often said to see the shades of gray between the black and the white, are actually better at seeing shades of gray than political extremists who only see things in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tested them and got perfect results, and he was completely enthusiastic. This is the kind of thing that goes right on The Daily Show or a TED Talk or a front page article in the Science Times. And then he made what in retrospect was a terrible mistake. He did the experiment again. And this time the results
disappeared.
Wait,
isn't that the whole scientific method? It has to be reproducible?
Yes, it is. But very few people bother to do this. You don't want to reproduce your own results for exactly the reason that Joe Nozick stumbled upon. You don't want to reproduce someone else's results because there's no percentage in it. You probably won't get a paper out of it. All you can do is make yourself an enemy. Even if you don't confirm the results, you may not get a paper out of it. Look, that's what scientists, that's what professors do. They publish papers. This is how they advance in their field. And so that's the desideratum. That's what they're trying for. So Nozick and some of his colleagues at the University of Virginia said, let's take a sample of papers that were published over the course of a year in three leading psychological journals and try and reproduce these experiments precisely. They recruited a bunch of quite a few experimental psychologists all over the country, and they contacted the original authors and said, tell me exactly what you did. And they have gone about trying to reproduce the results. And most of them do reproduce, which is heartening. Some of them don't. That doesn't mean that the original experimenters were corrupt or monkeying with the numbers or anything else. Remember, the standard is 19 out of 20.
Right.
You're supposed to achieve a 95% certainty that your results were not the result of chance. Well, that means 1 out of 20 very possibly are the result of chance, and so that's what people are looking for.
So Simmons and Nozick are among those suggesting that scientists do what differently to address some of these structural research problems?
Well, Nozick's project is under the rubric of the open science framework. And so open science means you publish or at least make available all of your methods, all of your results, that is the raw data before it is put into the publishable form as a paper. And certain other requirements, such as you establish ahead of time how many subjects you're going to be testing so that you can't do
You
can't just keep adding people until you get the right answer. Yeah.
Now, how do you think those recommendations might change the culture inside the scientific and, let's say, for truth's sake, the media community? Would there be fewer headlines on The Daily Show or Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or fewer superstars or TED Talkers?
Mm-hmm. Well, this isn't the first time in the history of science that this issue has come to the fore and that people have tried to address it in this way. You know, science is a highly competitive field, and people are ambitious, and you know they want grants, they want books, they need promotions, and so there is a tremendous incentive to try and cut corners to get ahead. The one thing that maybe is different now is that it is a lot easier to make material available through the internet. The repository of raw data can be established in a way that in the print era it really couldn't. There was no that stuff would have to be kept in a file drawer somewhere. So it is possible that we're going to see a somewhat stricter adherence to the scientific protocols that will improve the standards. But from the point of view of journalism, I mean, I was a science journalist myself, still am, really.
Yeah, and I have to make that point here, too, that we here at Word of Mouth and the magazine in which your article appeared, Pacific Standard, mm-hmm. are quite prone to putting these counterintuitive, you know, wow findings, potentially ambiguous science front and center. So what should we be doing differently as journalists?
I don't know that there's much that we can do differently as journalists. Our standard, the standard I held myself to at Newsweek for 25 years, was if something is in a respectable peer-reviewed publication, it's fair game. Mm-hmm. None of us are equipped to look into the data and look through the tables and charts and say, wait a minute, this doesn't seem quite right to us. We can't do that. Our job is to make this stuff accessible. The guardians have to be the editors of peer-reviewed journals, and maybe they need to shape up a little bit. There are some efforts on that too.
Well, Jerry Adler, I'm going to go listen to When I'm 64 and see what it does for me.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jerry Adler, author and journalist. You'll find a link to read his article, which was in Pacific Standard, called The Reformation. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. There is one public radio personality who is reliably skeptical of social science research, frequent Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist Paula Poundstone. Here she is, calling one such study into question.
Paula, a British psychologist, has determined that the best way for a man to attract a woman at a nightclub is to do what?
Show her money.
Actually, flash the cash.
Yes. Mm.
No. In order to do this correctly, one must wear a white polyester three-piece suit with a black shirt opened halfway to the navel.
Disco dancing?
Yes, but disco dancing specifically like whom?
Like John Travolta?
Exactly right. Dance like John Travolta. Women like nothing better than a man confident enough to strut his stuff Travolta style on the dance floor.
You know, I've really been suspect of some of the studies that you guys mentioned. Where did you get that study? Was it done by Mr. Cotter's class?
It must be true. We read about it on the internet.
Yeah. I
think it was funded by the John Travolta Sexual Attraction Foundation.
Yes. Okay, let me just say, there are so many factors that can't be controlled here.
That's Paula Poundstone and the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me crew poking a little fun at social science. Word of Mouth continues with a look into a curious tradition that's been lost over the years, funeral cookies, a treat called death, after the break.